Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love of Vodka O'Clock Podcast from AmberUnmasked.com. Today, my guest is Ryan Lindsay. Don't forget that we are an explicit website and podcast, so if you're easily offended or under 18, you should probably not be here. So Ryan and I are going to talk about Ghost Town from Action Lab Entertainment, among all of his other projects that he's working on. So for info about Ghost Town, you can head to actionlabcomics.com. Ryan, welcome to America, if you will.
Yes, thank you. I am just a little bit ahead of time. I'm talking to you from the future and excited to be here.
It is very cool because you're in the future of me, and then by the time this plays for the audience, they'll be playing a recorded show, so it'll be in the past, but they are then in the future because I don't know when they're going to listen to it.
It's so temporally challenging that we're going to have annotations. Absolutely.
I think so. My tricorder is all ready. We're
That's awesome. No, thanks for having me on. It's I like this podcast. I've listened to it a lot, and it's an honor to be here.
Oh, that's great. And we will talk about your show as well.
Oh, yes.
So let's talk about Ghost Town, because I had Dave Dwanch on the show, and it was probably like a year ago. I haven't talked and chatted with Dave in a while, but the Action Lab guys have launched this imprint for more mature-themed books, and it's called Action Lab Danger Zone.
Yeah.
And M-Theory, had the great guys from M-Theory have been on the show.
That's a good book. That is a really insane book. I dig that book.
Yeah, well, they are pretty insane guys. I love them. I absolutely love them. So I noticed that on Ghost Town, you're on issue two. So it's like the creative team changed from issue one to issue two. Is that going to be a thing where it's sort of like each little chapter is going to be told by different people, or was it just something that issue one got kicked off?
It was just we have a slightly larger than usual sort of creative team, because it's interesting that the way the story started was Rob Riddell is a guy who knows Dave, and is a guy who's very, very smart, and I caught up with him in Emerald City just a few months ago, and he had this loose idea that would then inform Ghost Town. It's about, for those who haven't sort of checked out the solicits, basically time travel is invented, and then very soon after it is stolen by terrorists, and they can send a bomb through time. And so what they can do is they can go to a place, send a bomb through time, and then say, all right, you've got 3 days until this bomb appears and blows up. So we would like, you know, certain demands met. And Rob came with that idea to Dave, and I can't remember what show they were at, but they were discussing it and getting very excited, and they really enjoyed it. Rob, now this is interesting. Rob says, you know, I'm not a writer, so I'm not going to, you know, write the book. But he is a writer, and he's a very good one. But he wasn't very sure whether he should take that book on or not. And so Dave Dwanch, who is such an awesome guy, I've just got to say that. I'm a big Dave fan. Yeah, it was really good to hang out with him in Seattle. He's just a bundle of energy. It's awesome. But though he is a bundle of energy, it is limited. He realized he couldn't take on the book either, because he's running a lot of Action Lab stuff, and he's writing Double Jumpers. So he's a very busy guy. So apparently what happened is they sort of thought about who they could possibly get on to aid with the writing of this book. And look, I don't even know. My name was somehow floated into this discussion.
Lucky you.
I know. I felt very honored. And Dave and I had actually been in discussions with him for a while. And he really wanted to work with me, and we wanted to put something together at Action Lab. And so, you know, I hit them up, and I said, and I think this is something that a lot of creators should do. I hit them up and I was like, all right, what sort of books are you looking for then? Like, I'm not going to start pitching my, you know, Crimean War romance if you're not into that genre.
Exactly.
So so I was like, what are you after? And he's like, oh, we're looking for maybe a bit of crime or sci-fi or Western. And so, I had this sort of sci-fi idea I'd been cooking up, and so I really sort of sat down and boiled the pitch up, and it was called Starcrossed. And It was about two intergalactic lovers from different races. She hyper-violent and though really wanted to have kids, and him much more sort of zen and placid, but holding it all together as a couple. It was about them traveling across the universe, trying to go on this journey to get certain answers. And we were kicking it back and forth, and it was going well. And amidst that process, Saga 1 dropped in stores. Yeah, there were a few similarities there, which just sort of made it feel like maybe we shouldn't be going down the faux saga path. So that was hugely disappointing, because I was loving this idea, but I could just see it at least wasn't the time. You couldn't do this hot on the heels of Saga. There were just too many parallels. One of which isn't that I'm anywhere near as good as Brian K. Vaughan, but I wish. And so that sort of got shelved, and we're sort of, you know, back and forth talking about other things. And so, yeah, I think when Ghost Town reared its head, they've sort of thought, oh, I think I know a guy that could do this book justice, and came to me. And I really dug the idea. And so what we then did was Rob, Dave and I sort of went back and forth and back and forth over this series Bible that we put together, because we've got quite a plan for Ghost Town.
That's great. Because, when you're collaborating like this, you really – organization is key, and communication, and make sure that everybody's on the same path.
That was one of the really fun things, because Dave and I, we've instantly fallen into this very brotherly relationship. And so we'd be kicking this Bible back and forth with, you know, all right, I'll add notes in red text. All right, I'll add blue text. All right, now my new notes are green text. And we'd be going forth, and we'd be hacking each other to pieces in the notes.
Sure.
But in a really good mannered way. Like, we know what our tone is. And, I know one of, the artists that comes on board with me, Daniel J. Logan, he was sort of in on all of this collaboration, and he sort of said to me, oh, dude, I was just sort of watching it back and forth with you and Dave, and I didn't know how it was going. And I was like, oh no, Dave and I know it's cool. This is just how we talk. Like, we get on Skype, and we'd be punching each other in the arm if you could do that through the internet. And he was like, oh, okay. Oh, I think I hear the tone of it now. Okay, it makes sense.
That's good.
So, Dave and I, we don't hold back, which is really nice. And it means that you can really get some honesty out of the story, and you can make certain plot beats be earned. And we bashed this thing into really good shape, and Rob and Daniel had really good notes, and it was fantastic. And so what we came out of it was that the very first issue that sets it all up, Dave was going to script that in a large, like a one shot. And then I'm going to come in with, my introductory arc, which is three issues. So, and it is a bit confusing, unfortunately, but I think people, I know people who are smart, so I assume people are smart, and they will totally get on board with, I write issues 2, 3, and 4, and that is my little opening, arc. And, it's a lot of fun. A lot of time has passed between my story and Dave's story in the first issue. And we open up on our main character, Nate Lawson, who is a man who ventures into the radius of one of these areas where a bomb is supposed to appear. And he retrieves things for people.
I loved that part. Actually, I really did prefer issue 2 over issue 1.
Yeah, take that, Dave. Yes.
Sorry. But yeah. But it did feel like I was much more connected to the characters, even like, you know, the bad guys, the gangster members. They just felt much more real.
Well, I mean, Dave had the unenviable position of he's got to drop a lot of exposition in number, and he does it with some amazing Justin Greenwood art. And but he's got to set up a lot of things, and he's got to set up these terrorists, and they do tie in back later. There are certain sort of people from that issue that are going to be pivotal later on. But for my opening three issue arc, we start exploring the people who have decided to stay back in what we call the RAD, which is the radius area around Washington D.C. that has been evacuated. And that was really the hook that initially grabbed me from the very start. It's this idea of why would people stay there? Right. And there are so many good reasons why that would actually happen. And as we beat it out, I was like, oh, okay,
If you've ever seen, before we hit the record button, we were talking about the strange weather that we have here in the States and with the tornado disasters and last year's hurricanes. And there are people that won't leave.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like, you know, the powers that be are telling you, you have to get out. It is not safe.
You
will probably not survive this if you stay, or, you know, whatever. You will be putting lives in danger of the rescue workers that then need to come get you.
Yeah.
And people, just some of them won't leave. And then there is the whole looting mentality, that as soon as there's a disaster, the looters come in.
That's definitely one of the big things that we were sort of thinking about. It's that idea that we mapped out. We really tried to do a lot of world building before we went into this world. And I thought about, why would people stay? And there's that idea that if it's been evacuated, you could just go in there and you could have the best house. You could just go in and take it. Like, there's nothing to stop you. So there's people who are doing that. There are some people that just flat out don't believe it's coming. It's propaganda. It's government bullshit. Like, whatever. There are some people that move in to make a stand and say, no, we Americans will not be forced from our land. We will not cede to these terrorists. And they actually go into the RAD. They decide to go in there and say, no, our presence makes a statement. There are some people that just have nothing better to go to. They'd rather spend 5 happy years in there, or however long they think they've got. It could be 5 days. They'd rather spend it there with a bit of ownership. I mean, one of the characters, Martin, he's like the leader of sort of what we've called like the homeless guys, basically, who are just like, they're not hassled there, and they feel like they have purpose, and they can tend to land, and they can do things that they can't do in the real world because they don't have the setup or the backing or the finances. And so there's all these reasons why people would go in there. And then there's Nate, who people pay him. They'll say, like, look, It was an insane evacuation. A bomb was about to come down. So, you know, we left a car behind. We left a laptop behind. We left our grandmother's jewelry behind. Certain things are there where there's illicit photos of me and my mistress there, and I cannot have them found. Go in and get these things. And so I've got a long list of things that Nate has taken out of the RAD and things that he may take in future stories. And, we won't spoil it in this discussion, but, the thing that he is after in this initial arc is something different. When I pitched my opening arc to Dave, I think this was really what solidified me getting the gig. I sort of said, all right, here's what he needs to get out of the RAD. And Dave was like, interesting. And then I was like, and here's what happens at the end. And he was like, all right, yeah, boom, yeah, all right, that's so hooked me. And it's really validating to hear that from your editor. So I was like, all right, I feel good. I think we're all on the same page. I think it's going forward. So there's a good hook at the end of this, but my first issue, which is issue 2, and it just builds until I tried to create a really tight 3-issue arc that explores the RAD, explores the characters, and explores Nate most of all. He is the leading man. He is our, we've been channeling, somewhere between Han Solo and Sawyer from Lost.
Yeah. He's a nice, strong protagonist because, I was a fan of the show that sadly did not last very long, called The Finder.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
And it was a spinoff from the show Bones, but, Michael Clark Duncan was one of the stars on it, and he had passed away right after the show got canceled, I think. Same premise where this, you know, their lead character, Walter, is just a very bizarre fellow with PTSD, but he has a gift for finding things that people have lost. And it could be the most bizarre thing, like find, it wouldn't necessarily be like a trinket because that's something tangible that somebody can find, but it could be like, find my favorite, dinner that I had in 1970 or something like that. And he'll figure it, like, find the chef to recreate the dinner to make, you know.
Oh, that's insane.
Like, really nutso stuff.
Yeah.
That's
a cool idea.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, we've got.
That's what he reminded me of.
Yeah, he's trying to get in. He's trying to work out how to get these things. And unfortunately, it's not all idyllic in the RAD. There are violent elements, and Tyrell is the main representative of that, a sort of gang warlord who has decided to settle in because, hey, man, it's easy to deal drugs in the RAD to the people who are just sort of drugged out and staying there. It's no cops there hassling you whatsoever. And it's sort of easy as fuck, and it's a nice clean power grab for him. It's that idea of, oh, I can easily rise to the top of this little heap. And he's a really interesting character. I found that the more I dug into him, the more I was like, oh, there are some real layers here. And I mean, one of the first scenes there, you see him getting his henchmen to kill another guy that is, you know, sort of displeased him, another guy that is in his crew. And it was a nice little brutal scene to sort of write and say, right, this is our character. He will have ups and downs, but at his heart, he's a brutal thug and he's violent and he is terrible. We sort of want to paint that his core is rotten, but like any person, he is multidimensional and he has weaknesses and he has good points, but we really did want to posit him as not a very nice person. So he's fun to write, I'll say that much.
I love the way, because it was, you said Daniel Logan did the art on two, right?
Yeah, he's my guy.
Because it was definitely different, and there was this very specific change at that point, obviously, between his style and issue one, the style there. It did feel like it was a very, like, urban graffiti type of influence, and I'm like, wow, this is, like, really perfect for, you know, for this setting and these characters and the gangs. You know, and then you do see, like, the walls with graffiti on it. It just sort of, like, brings it all together.
Yeah, he's an amazing collaborator. I've actually, it's what I call my Daniel Logan trilogy. I've done three short stories with him. One was in the Oxymoron book from Comics Tribe. One is on the Challenger Comics website called Survivor. And the third was our backup that we did in Kurt Weeb's Grim Leaper, the second issue of that. And every time that I worked with Daniel, it was just like, oh, man, this is awesome. It's going so well. And when we got paired on Ghost Town, I could not have been – it was perfect. It was perfect. We've got a really good sort of succinct style. And he brings a lot to the table, man. He'll go through my scripts and be like, why is this happening? This person should say this instead.
Yeah.
Daniel speaks an amazingly fluent tongue in drug. He knows how people on the street really talk, man. He'd be tweaking my dialogue, being like, no, they should say this word. And I'm like, oh, man, you're living on the streets, aren't you? And he's like, no, I got a job. And I'm like, you live on the streets, man. You can tell me. So he's really, really good. And he was like, all right, I want this sort of a logo or sort of emblem for Tyrell in his world. And he sort of came up with these designs. And I was like, oh, man, that you had this idea and you can execute it is amazing. And I wanted Nate to have this tattoo on his arm, and Daniel came back with these designs, and I think I want the tattoo now. It was,
poor guy, he'd have to draw that in like every panel. Does he realize what tattoos
do? I sort of raised that. I was like, are you really cool like with this? And he's like, no, we'll do it like this, and this is how we're gonna do it, and this is how we'll keep consistency. And he was, oh man, he's a dream artist to work with because he makes it happen. He makes me look good, and I can just sometimes put into the script, all right, this is roughly what's going to happen, and Daniel, I have all the faith that you're going to make the rest of the page flow and work, because this and this and this will happen, and he strings it together.
Do you do your breakdowns by panel, or do you do it more?
I do full script.
Full script.
Yeah, I am generally full script. There's an action sequence that I scripted where I was like, here's what's going to happen. You can work out if you want to break it into four or three or whatever panels, you know, where the beats will go. Because I know he's really good at that stuff. And I know when I full script it, he has the opportunity and option, of course, to change it. And sometimes so often will that I just thought on this one, he's the guy to do this with. Yep. Just run wild with this page and know that it'll come out well.
So then how do you put your dialogue into a script like in that style? You just like do a whole prose paragraph about what's going on and sprinkle the dialogue in, or do you put the dialogue specifically like after your descriptions of everything?
For a page like that where I sort of almost Marvel style it, I would just have like, all right, we're going to fit these, you know, four captions on the page or whatever. And After the art comes back, we can then work out exactly where they should sit or if we need to tweak it. I mean, as it is, the art will come in sometimes and we'll sort of say, all right, this beat was actually a bit smaller, so we're going to bump, you know, caption two from that panel into the next one, which is a larger beat. And Daniel's really good at noticing, you know, every page has to have its one big beat, and he's really good at making that pop, I feel. So there's always that sort of back and forth, but usually I write in full script, and so it's, you know, panel one, these captions, panel two, these captions. But every now and then it's fun to throw a little something out and just say, all right, let's make some magic happen. And he's so hands-on with the script. Sometimes before I send the script to the editorial, I'll run it past Daniel and just say, what are you feeling with this? Are you liking where the story is sitting? Are there any larger beats you want to hit, sort of thing? And he'll come back with a lot of notes in the document and sort of say, all right, this can go here. This page could actually be broken down like this. There's a little fight sequence in that, my first issue, where Nate is heading into a hotel, and he just worked his magic. Daniel really sort of just took that and was like, all right, here's how I'm going to now set this page out. And the way he uses foreground and perspective just blew me away. It was things that I certainly didn't script. I was just sort of like, all right, he's hitting this person in this way, but, you know, Daniel would have the gun right up close to the reader, and it would just look amazing. So it's a really good flow with him and I, and that's one of the reasons I'm really looking forward to the future of Ghost Town as well, because having that back and forth with him it's exciting. That's really the only way to put it.
Well, what is the future of Ghost Town? Does it have a definitive limited series ending, or is this something that Action Lab has planned as ongoing for as long as they can keep it going?
We're hoping to sort of push it forward into, as they call, like the Hellboy sort of
mini
method
arcs.
Of this, mini arcs.
Mini arcs are great. Yeah, I really am a big fan of those.
Yeah, I think they're really a great way to go. And I think they work for this story. It has you can watch seasons of a show in succession and they can all build, but when they're done right, each season has its own little feel, its own sort of a tone and hook. And we're sort of trying to do that with the arcs as well. And so, I mean, this first arc that I'm writing is very much just here is Nate Lawson and here is his world and here is how he operates in it. And so it's very central around him. Whereas looking to another arc that I'm plotting out, it's very much like this is the rad, and here is how the people within it really operate. And we get our scope widens, and at the moment I'm tentatively calling that arc War. So that should that should give some idea to the sort of it's going to be a lot bigger. So we're hoping that we can, you know, get to all of those tales. Being such a small nascent publisher. We're really hoping that people get out there with their pre-orders. And issue two was just in the May previews.
It was. So, it was order code I'm going to throw in there. The order code was May 130764, if you guys are looking into your order codes and helping out your local comic shop with how they order things. That'd be great.
Because, I mean, yeah, thank you for that. We will live and die by the pre-orders. We are not a book that can wait for later, sort of thing. We need to get a bit of a fan base now, and that will pick up the book and will sample it. And I'm certain they will enjoy it. That's for sure. It is a really interesting hook for a story. But then we're making sure that we tell it through dense characters. We want to make sure that it's meaty. I want it to be worthwhile for people's money. That's for sure.
It's going to be on Comixology as well.
Yes, Action Lab are through Comixology as well, so they will be able to digitally download it.
Great.
And hopefully we'll have lots of future tales to tell in Ghost Town. It's such a rich idea that you could do so many things with it.
I like it. I'm going to have to see if I can track Daniel down and get him on the show too. Or run into him somewhere. I don't know. Where's he from?
He's out in California.
Okay. I'm not sure if he would ever do the East Coast conventions then.
I don't know if he has. No, he came up to Seattle, but I don't know if he ever ventures cross country. He will eventually, because he'll only be getting bigger and better work. He's such a good dude. Yeah, it was. It's nice when you collaborate with someone and they're just a really good person. That's for sure. He's very cool. And him and I are also looking at it. He's going to help contribute to a little something I've got brewing for the future. So I'm always trying to maximize the Daniel J. Logan in my life.
Aww, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So how did you meet him?
Through Justin Greenwood, actually. I had this idea for a short. The first short we did together was Survivor. And Justin and I have talked from a fair way back in the day. Him and I actually put a pitch together a while back. And it didn't get picked up, unfortunately. But I sort of kept on chatting with him. He's such a nice guy, it's hard not to. And I was chatting to him about this short. And I was like, do you know anybody that... I mean, and I'm sure a lot of writers go through this. It is so hard to find artists out there because they're taken or they're working on something else or it's or they don't match.
Need a lot of money.
it's sort of insane. And so Justin pushed me towards Daniel, and he read this first short Survivor and was like, yeah, I dig it. Let's put it together. And he sent me, I think it was 2 or 3 pages of concept sketches for. It's about this, it's sort of set in space. It's a sci-fi tale of a man and his baby running away from an almost omnipresent alien, just destructive force. And it's him on the run trying to survive. And so Daniel brought all these sort of sketches and concepts for the vehicle in the short and the aliens and what this spaceport bar looked like. And I was instantly just enamored. So that was fortuitous. It's sort of nice when somebody can sort of push you towards another creative and it clicks and it works. And, I mean, that was about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And we've sort of been...
just found ways to partner up ever since, huh?
Putting things together, yeah. When I got the backup opportunity for Grim Leaper, Daniel was the first person I spoke to about it. I was like, do you want in on this short? And, he was all over it. That was a lot of fun, actually. And it's about a lady who, because the idea of the shorts in that book were love stories to die for. And, so in my short, it's a guy who falls in love with a girl, but her kink is that she just feeds and feeds and feeds. And so we watch him in, like 3 pages go from this sort of hunky guy to this absolute blob of a man. Just gargantuanly large, and Daniel did this amazing work that you can still see it's the same guy, even though his head nearly sort of doubles in width, like that he can keep it, the facial sort of tweaks and structures, in place that it makes sense. It was really nuanced storytelling, and he nailed it. And we actually were really lucky. We got Jordi Belair to color that short, and so it came up.
Nice.
So perfect. I got the first page of that short, and Daniel gave it to me in Seattle, and it is sitting in my office. It is I think it's like an 8 or 9 panel page, sort of just set out, not a clean grid, but with like a banner image up top and then one down the bottom. So yeah, it's 8 panels. And when I was coming to Seattle, Daniel was like, "All right, I got to pack some art, dude. What do you want?" And I was like, "Well, how much is it? And I can work out how many I can get." And he was like, no, just what do you want?" And that in itself sells Daniel as just a dude. So I was like, "Oh, wow, well, I'll take that first page from Lovesick." And it's such a pretty page. And then when Jordi colored it, it just looked...
Yeah, that's some fine work there.
Beautiful. Oh, she is an amazing colorist.
Yeah.
She really gets what she's doing. But she's so super busy.
Yeah, once these artists get in demand, you're so screwed, right?
Oh, yeah, they're gone, yeah. I try and sort of get what collaboration I can before these people, you know, bounce out of my stratosphere way too busy, which is... And I'm always so pleased to see... I mean, by the time I worked with Jordi, she was already somebody, that's for sure. She was just very nice to do me a favor and color 5 pages.
Well, cool. How did you end up on the My Little Pony one-shot for Rainbow Dash? Because I'm a huge fan of this series. I love My Little Pony. And it was great. I couldn't believe it. I mean, those are some very different writing styles.
From, drug kingpins slaying people and throwing their bodies into the river in D.C. to Rainbow Dash.
Rainbow Dash.
A logical progression, and if you can believe it, I personally blame Ed Brubaker and Dwayne Swierczynski for slide into that, because way back in 2009, I wrote a backup essay for Criminal, the Brubaker Sean Phillips book.
Sure.
And then had that sitting in my resume back pocket for a while. And, you know, Ed was really awesome to run it. I wrote about Australian noir flicks. And then Swazinski put up on Twitter that Godzilla was going to be having backup essays, the book that he's writing at IDW. And him and I had emailed a few times back and forth. I love his work. His novels are some of the best pacing and action ever. And I dig his comic work. I really do. And so I dropped him a line and was like, so you're doing essays. You know, I wrote one for Criminal. Like, you know, I can do this. And he was like, oh, absolutely. Boom. Let's get you into it. And so I wrote this backup essay called Radioactive Creativity, which just looked at how batshit insane the Godzilla universe is. It's nuts, man. You look at just how much creativity they've poured into that world over decades.
Yeah, it's a lot of monsters.
It's wild. And the weapons and the divisions and everything. Like, I love that whole sort of mythos. And so from that stepping stone, it meant that I had to run my essay past a very lovely editor at IDW, Bobby Kernow. And so through doing that, I sort of started talking to him and was sort of asking what if I could give him some of my other comic work. And I was giving him my, you know, my Daniel Logan trilogy and some other works. And he sent me an email and he was like, oh, look, we're pretty topped up at the moment for things. He goes, but there is an opening for My Little Pony, but I don't really know if you're sort of into that or if you know about it.
And everybody's into it. Everybody.
I actually hadn't watched the show yet. And I sort of read this email and I was like, oh, okay. And I let it sit there for the weekend. And then my wife, who at the time was pregnant, we went and had a baby scan on the Monday and we found out we were having a little girl. And instantly, I had to drive straight to work from the scan in the car. I was just like, I could write something for this girl. I could get something. And I had like three ideas by the time I got to work. I started polishing them. I sent them in, and two of them, Bobby was just like, dude, it's a comic for kids. You get that right. He's like, mystical kung fu tournament with ponies. Maybe just a little above. He was like, and the cameo from the Joker style pony, maybe a little too dark. Let's look at this third one that you've got for Rainbow Dash. And oh man, he's such a good editor to work with. And so we workshopped it and got it through. And I landed the gig. It was a real strange process to end up in Equestria. I must admit,
it is quite a different world.
It's so out of my wheelhouse. I've never written a lot of all ages stuff, and it's just sort of not where I tend to skew. And so I wanted this gig so bad because I was like, I can do this, damn it. And so once I got it, I was like, oh, now I've got to do this, damn it. And so it sort of changed around, and it was so much fun to write. It was just unbelievably, just like gleefully fun to write this story. And I tried to make the villains in it a little bit dark. I did want them to be a threat and to feel a little imposing.
Well, they do. The changelings that were in Katie Cook's arc, they were pretty dark.
Exactly. Yeah, and once I got to read her first two issues before they dropped, and I was like, oh, okay, so we can do this. All right. And so I polished this script. I don't know how many drafts I went through, but I kept just going, nope, it can be tighter. Nope, it can be funnier. And I'm a primary school teacher, so I teach year five. And so they're about 10 years old. And before it was announced, but I did have the gig, I sort of went into class and I saw a girl with like a pony. She'd drawn a pony. I was like, oh, do you like My Little Pony? And she was like, yeah, blah, 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 and went on about it. And I was like, okay. And I just sat down. I was like, who's your favorite? Oh, it's Rainbow Dash for sure. And I was like, oh, really? Why? And she blurted out, like, because she's so forceful and headstrong, and she understands who she is. And she had these really, like, meaty concepts of, she wasn't just like, oh, she's totes funny. Like,
she's blue. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. She was like, no, this pony is strong willed and, you know, she can do anything. And I was just like, oh man, awesome. So I started to craft this story about, well, what happens when she can do anything, but it's not working, and tried to get that confidence of Rainbow Dash and really break it to pieces. I don't know. It seems weird to say this, but in trying to structure a My Little Pony one shot, I kept thinking about what Scott Snyder always says, which is, you know, you take the character and you pit them against their opposite, or you pit them against something that what they normally do doesn't work, and you see how that breaks the character. I think it was a quote from Louis C.K. I saw on Twitter recently, which is, take all the things that you're good at and remove them, and then you will improve. And I was like, whoa, yeah, that actually sums up what I was trying to go for. You take away what she does best, or why she feels she does it best. And that was the big thing for the character. It's all in her head. She's such a cerebrally complex character. Everything's tied up in her sort of self-confidence. And as that got shot through my issue, it was fun to see her try and regroup and then finally realize she could regroup all she wanted to sort of, because she felt she shouldn't, because she felt she could, and then realize, no, it's not about her. It's about others.
That's always the message with the My Little Ponies, and it's, I guess, why they have the, you know, the subtitle, Their Friendship is Magic, because they've always got a support structure to help them, and it's such a great show. It's a great comic. And what's cool, like you were saying about Rainbow Dash having, there's always like, you know, what is her strong suit, and she would feel that it was her flying, obviously. So each one of them, like, they're so different. Like, them, I love that about the pony universe, that, you know, not all of them fly, you know. It's just they have very different, not races, but, you know, that they're
yeah, I know, you know,
qualities.
Yeah.
There's different qualities per pony, and, you know, some are...
It's not like getting the Superman family together and they can all fly. And
they all,
you know,
do the same exact thing. Yeah.
These guys, they need to have support structures in place, and they need to rely on others. And together they can sort of cover everything, but even then they've still got to be supporting each other to do their part. It's like they're like a phalanx, really.
Yeah.
So you can't have sort of one falling down.
Sort
and so
of like
they make
Voltron.
Sure yes. And so, oh, man, the more I dug into it, the more I was like, oh, this is good. And I was sort of watching shows and really, like, just immersed myself. And I did a lot of internet research, and it was interesting because a few pony websites interviewed me, and they all sort of seemed to want to broach that topic. They were like, so did you look up stuff online, and how did it make you feel? And I'm like, there's a lot of pony stuff online, and some of it, like, I didn't say it in their interviews, but I'll sort of say it here. That Flank, which talks about pony asses, that's a weird meme. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, or maybe it's actually really innocent or something. I don't know, but it just looks like it's not, it's sort of, I think it's meant to be making fun of people who, I don't know. I don't even know if I want to talk about it in depth.
I'm not even sure which meme this is, because I love, I mean, I've you know, Google image search for ponies before.
If you image search for that, D-A-T, and Flank, it just sort of shows, like, Brokeback images of ponies, and it says That Flank on it. And that was not a meme
creepy
that I referenced in my issue. Yeah, so there were some rabbit holes that you could fall far down. But there was a lot of really cool stuff, and I used a bit of the memery, if you will, in my issue. I used like a 20% cooler and bro hoof, and I found it really interesting. After my issue dropped, I chimed in on a few of the different major pony forums, because people were sort of talking about what they liked, or they had questions and things like that, and they're a super fun community to engage with. And so I'd pop in, and some people were like, oh, I really didn't like the use of the memes. Like, he referenced 20% cooler, like, whatever, it's been done, like, get over it. But the reason I did it is because I spoke to some of the kids at school, because they were ultimately, like, the personification of my target audience. I was like, what do you think about this? And the girl was in question was like, oh, I have a shirt with 20% cooler on it. It is the coolest. Like, they loved it. And so a lot of people did enjoy the meme work in there. But a lot of people were like, it would have been better if it wasn't referencing that. So it's interesting to see, you know, obviously you're never going to please everybody, but sort of who appreciates certain subtle areas. In the end, I'm really glad I did a lot of that internet research, and I think it benefited the issue. And I always tried to put it in there, but still be either servicing the story or part of the narrative. So it sort of things didn't just stop and tangent into a dead end so I could have a broke hoof.
You can have the best joke ever. I've heard TV writers talk about this too. You can have, you can have the best joke, but if it needs to be forced into the script, then it's not going to work anyway. It just, it needs to be a natural placement. You just like take that joke, put a pin in it and save it for a different show.
Yeah, exactly. So it was, and there were a lot of things I threw onto the page that, that didn't end up making it there, just me trying different things. But in the end, it always came down to me saying, all right, this scene, not this joke, but this scene, what's it about? Where am I coming from? Where am I going to? Is that happening? And then, I don't know, I did try and layer in a lot of, like, pop culture references, and I went pretty crazy with that stuff because it was just so much fun. And actually, I did a write-up on my website of sort of like a commentary or annotation of the issue, and just was like, all right, this is where this line comes from, and this is a variation on this line. And when I wrote it all down, I was like, man, I was really like just dropping a lot of little things about a lot of different stuff. And it was some of it, like, people got some were like, all right, the Blade Runner speech, the Tannhauser Gate speech, they were like, all right, that's very clearly in there. And there's a reference from a Simpsons episode with, you know, the goggles do nothing. People loved that, which I didn't realize they were going to love it. But there were little lines, like I took a Fight Club line and I just tweaked it. And I took a line from Dave Chappelle's Charlie Murphy Real Hollywood Stories with Rick James, and I tweaked that line. And I inserted it so it's not a punchline, it's just sort of in there. And you may see it or you may not, and in the end, if I did it for myself and made myself laugh, I'm probably still just as happy. But one of the guys, Matt Malikoff at Multiversity Comics, he noticed that I stole a line from the classic Western Tombstone.
Oh.
And I didn't think anyone was going to see it. I didn't think anyone was going to get it. And he totally, like, he got it instantly. And I was like, respect. That was very, very well picked out. And I mean, it's not, I don't think it's that obscure that no one would see that I've tweaked the line and put it in there, but it wasn't one that I thought would stand out, but hey, one person got it, or at least told me they got it, and that made me smile. I got
well, it's funny because I had said to Katie on Twitter that I wanted, because The Lone Ranger is my favorite comic, and so I was just like, oh, why hasn't Silver made an appearance in Equestria yet? And she's like, go back and read it. She's like, there's the Silver reference. I'm like, oh, crap, how did I miss it?
There's so much, and I mean, yeah, I read a lot of Pony stuff in preparation for it, and I also read a bit of Adventure Time. That comic is that is rapid fire. It is a machine gun of just ideas and chatter and references, and I read a bit of that and was like, all right, I can see, I just sort of wanted to get that structural tone a little bit, and then I'd go back and read some Pony and be like, all right, always Ponify it, but all right, I think I know the kids' comic that I want to write. And a teacher, a friend of mine, walked into my classroom the other week, and I was selling an issue to a kid, like, just after the bell had gone, and he was like, look at you, you dealer. He asked me, he came up and was like, can you bring one in tomorrow, because my local shop sold out. We ordered a lot, and we did two signings and sold them all out.
Nice.
So I was like,
congratulations. All right,
it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of cool people come through in the signing, and I got to bro hoof somebody, and I got a lot of photos, and a lot of little kids shyly coming up saying, you know, I love Rainbow Dash. And I was like, me too. And then I signed their book. So yeah, it was a blast. I just ordered a few extra copies because I've got two, major Australian cons in the next like month and a half. So I'm ready to represent and sell a few more in some other cities.
Fantastic. Well, let's talk about your cons, because you did Emerald City, which kind of like kicks off the U.S. Con season.
Yeah.
They're like, it's like the first show. So were you going Perth or?
No, I'm going Sydney in 3 weeks, and then 3 weeks after that is Melbourne.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Sydney one is Supernova, and then down in Melbourne I'll be going to Oz Comic Con. And we have a decent con scene down here.
Yeah, sure.
I've noticed that we have sort of a comparable to the U.S. percentage and quality of cosplayers.
Yeah, I know. I look at all the pictures. It's amazing.
Yeah, we have an insanely really good culture of cosplaying. Last year at Supernova in Sydney, I saw this Batwoman, J.H. Williams III Batwoman, and she was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, flat out amazing. We have some really, really cool cosplay. I thought, oh, America must be wild, but theirs was sort of just as good. And I was like, oh, okay, we're really good at this. So I liked it down here.
I think it was it Stuart McKinney, maybe? I don't remember. Yeah. There's a couple friends of mine from, like, Facebook and stuff, and they'll post the pictures of all the cosplay. And it's really cool. And it's great for shows, you know, that I can't get to.
Yeah.
You know, like Dragon Con. Like, I'm not going to go to Dragon Con or anything, but it's like I will spend hours looking at other people's photos.
Yeah. There's some pretty wild, like, just outfits and stuff, like the skill that goes into making them. And I love it. I'd sit there floored, and sitting at a table and watching it go by is can be really cool. Although I think it was last year as well that, I don't know if it's called crossplay or not, but it should be. It's dudes dressing as chicks.
Yeah, and basically.
That threw me off. I'd never really seen that before. And you'd be like, oh, this is an interesting looking Sailor Moon. And then some dude's head would pop out from behind the wig. And I'm like, oh, come on, man. I'm here to live dreams, not create nightmares.
It depends on if they're doing it respectfully or if they're doing it mockingly. Like, you know, if they're doing it like the big hairy guys that are in the slave Leia bikinis just because. You cannot tell me that they're doing it for the love of the character. They're not. They're doing it to just be like, I'm going to be like, you know, get my picture taken in the slave Leia bikini.
Yeah, they're trying to be dicks. So I think actually every dude that I've seen, they certainly had the bodies for it, whatever that says about whatever I'm saying. Not outing myself at all. They certainly like look like they were doing it, you know, for realsies.
Real. Cool. So you've got kids now. You've got, I mean, dressing up
kids. I've got two kids, yeah. So they're going to be my little cosplayers.
Yeah, it's like you get them early.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think I can easily make that happen because it was last year again, someone came up and actually thought I was like cosplaying. I was just literally standing there. And they were like, no, you're Will Wheaton. Like, that's what you're doing, yeah?
Oh my God.
I just looked at him and I was like, really? And he was like, dude, like 100%. And he was serious. And I'm like, this is not cosplay. This is me standing next to my table. And he's just like, oh, well, you do a pretty good Will Wheaton, man. And he walked off and I was like, all right, apparently nondescript bearded guy is now Will Wheaton cosplay, so...
There you go.
I'm thinking maybe this year I'll just get a white shirt and a skinny black tie and I'll be Faraday from Lost. That's the next step. I think I can feel like there is no cosplay for me because I have a beard. I feel like there aren't that many characters I can do. I don't know. Maybe people can give me some shout-outs after this and be like, no, you can totally be Will Wheaton. So, you know, thanks.
Yeah, so you guys, that's your challenge is to go tweet to Ryan K. Lindsay's Twitter and tell him what his cosplay would be.
I am a nondescript, average height-sized bearded dude with dark, very dark hair. I can't be Danny Rand. I can't be... I'd have to trim it down if I want to be Iron Man. And I'm
going to say, Tony Stark is about the only thing I was thinking of. You'd have to...
I'd have to become, like, 50 times more suave for a weekend. I just don't know if I've got that level of commitment, man. I don't know. I'm sort of like, I'm pushed out of a lot of cosplay. There's just not enough for me. I could go as Zangief from Street Fighter.
You got to...
Just, like, trim sides.
Put your heart into the cosplay, and you got it like shaved just for the week.
I know, but even then I'm just nondescript, clean shaven, dark haired dude. I don't know who that is either.
Then you can wear a mask or something.
Well, I could mask up, yeah. Although they're so hot in those masks, man.
It's, I don't know how they do it, but yeah, you could do a full
3 minutes and dead no good
or Spider-Man or something.
Yeah. I could absolutely rock that out. I could do Sailor Moon. That seems to be the going cultural currency, the last cons I went to. Maybe I could step up the game. I have some pretty tight gams, if I do say so myself.
Well, yeah, or you could do the brony thing.
Oh, yes.
Do the brony thing. Actually, a guy that I know from Philadelphia did the most amazing pony, and I'm totally blanking on the name now. It's the guy, it's the one that Rainbow Dash, like, has a crush on from that, like, particular flight school.
From the Wonderbolts?
Yes, yes. The one.
Yeah, he's in my issue.
I'm totally, like, blanking on the name.
I'm being outed as a fraud. I can't remember it.
But, a little shout out to Greg with his brony cosplay. It was so stunning.
That's pretty tight. I don't know. Usually I'm at a con just to chill out. So, I dig the cosplay idea and I love that people do it. And I just, I'm so lazy. I'm lucky to be wearing clothes at the con. Like,
but do you have Halloween? Do you guys?
We don't really. Yeah. If you've got kids, like, I live in a cul-de-sac. So like a dead end road. And there's like maybe 10 houses. And so there's a lot of these houses have kids. And so sometimes they'll just do a little trick or treat up the road. And, I always hand out like 1980s back issues that I have. Like, do you guys like old Thor? And they're like, woohoo, yeah! And I hand it out, so.
That's good. Until the moms and dads open it and there's like, you know, scantily clad chick in her underwear coming out of Tony Stark's bedroom or something. Like, what did that guy give you?
Yeah, I have comics in my classroom a lot, and I use them with literacy, and a girl walked up to me and was like, there's a bad word in this comic, and I'm like, nonsense, it's an old Marvel comic, and I opened it up, and I was like, and Nascenti, damn you, and I put that Daredevil issue away, so you got to be careful sometimes, yeah, but usually it's not too bad. I love using comics for literacy. I really in-depthly taught Bone and Return of the Dapper Men. And both of those go down really well. And I had a girl that I taught Bone to came back the next term, and she had like the big Bone omnibus.
Yeah,
I made my parents give me this on my birthday, and I'm like, yes, inception complete. One down, there's 6 billion to go. It was, but I just love it. There's so much sort of nuance that you can teach in how the storytelling progresses, and 10, 11 year olds get it. And I had them creating their own little, 2-page comics. And we were looking at, you write your intro page and then you use the page turn. So they're starting on the right and they're using the page turn. And some of them like got it instantly and were writing these amazing like dynamic moments that would jump out at you on the page turn. It was brilliant. Like,
that's great. Well, where did you learn? Who taught you?
My oldest brother was a Marvel zombie way back in the day. So comics just always existed in my house. And so I've always loved reading and writing. And since I was about... since year three, so what was I, about eight, I've always known I was going to be a writer. And I wrote to then. I wrote this awesome story called Volcano about this guy that packs a bag, and I spent like half a page being like, and then he puts in muesli bars, and then he threw in apples and all this sort of stuff. And then there's like two sentences on, he walks up the volcano. He stops. He looks at a wolf. They look at each other. He keeps walking. He gets to the top. He looks in the volcano. Then he walks home, and that was the story. So, I'm hoping I've gotten better over time.
You've grown a bit.
But yeah, I always wrote back then, and I don't think I was as conscious of like unpacking comics back then, but it was always just, it was a form of literacy expression that existed in my head, and you could see things that way. And, you know, reading Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics.
Great book, yeah.
Explicitly made clear things I already knew. Is probably the best way that I would put it. He talks about like the gutters and how they are storytelling devices in themselves. And I'm like, oh yeah, I totally get that. Because you have this and then you jump to this. I was already doing that. And cool. All right. So now I know what to call it when I tell the artist what I want. If I'm inserting a gutter across an image. I saw recently in the Judge Dredd, that Swazinski and Nelson Daniel are doing at IDW. They use a gutter through an image, and the gutter is actually the path of the bullet.
Oh, that's awesome. Man.
And it actually like goes through the character's shoulder. Just superb storytelling right there. Like I love those little things. I find it now hard to just read a book. I read it and I'm like, I'll go back and I'll count how many panels are on the pages and I'll average it out. And I'm like, okay, I can remember reading the Thor, the Thor and Cap team up for Free Comic Book Day that Langridge and Somni did. And it was like averaging like 9 panel pages or something insane.
Yeah, and that's why when people tell me that it's not possible to do that many on a page, I'm like, then you don't know what you're talking about, because it's been done well.
Yeah, as long as you're scripting the right stuff, I'll see people that write a script with it's like, 9-panel grid, first scene, explosion, second scene, 70 ninjas grapple with a plane, and I'm like, dude, no, that's not going to work. Like,
that's a bit much.
But but if you have the right story or the right characters or the right moment for that page, you can absolutely do it and do it insanely well. Like, I mean, one of the pages in the Pony book, I think Tony did like 13 panels. But that was the Dark Knight Returns like TV screen homage page.
Oh yeah, that was great.
Oh man,
but that's one of the things that I always go back to is like, yeah, you know, Frank Miller could do it, and it's like, no, I'm, you know, not saying that there's a, you know, a new generation of Frank Miller somewhere, but I'm just saying it can be done.
Yeah.
And you know,
if you meet it out correctly and with purpose, you can do just about anything.
Yeah, and don't do it just because you're trying to squish stuff together. I mean,
it can be done poorly. Unfortunately, everything can be done poorly, but
of course,
you can always do these things well. And I don't know. I had an interesting chat with Jason Cherimella, who wrote Joe Hill's The Cape at IDW,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking about every page should be, I think he said, 4 panels. He said you can sell the page, you can sell page beats in 4 panels. He's like, you don't necessarily need to stick to that, but you can aim for that and you can make it happen. You can be, you know, succinct enough. And I do that a lot when I polish a script. I go to each page and I'm like, can I remove a panel? Can I take that action and put it somewhere else? Is one of the actions superfluous? Can the gutters cover what's happening there? Can the inflection in the next caption intonate what had happened in between or where he went or how he's feeling? Like, I'm more of a 5 panel a page guy. Like, I noticed that. It just inherently comes out. I don't always aim for it, but that's often what I find will occur.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that.
I like to float between 5 and 7, somewhere around there.
I do, yeah. My average would be 5 point something.
Yeah.
It would not be 4.8. But I don't know, every time I'll write a page that has like 3 panels and I'm like, I feel like there's not enough there.
Nothing there. That's how I feel. I'm like, but what could be going on? I mean, it's like, yeah, there's plenty of room for the art, which is important. Yeah. But it's like my brain needs to see that first before I can just
say. Yeah, once I see it, I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I was like, you go read Brian K. Vaughan's Ex Machina, and it's 4 panel pages, like nearly, like without fail. And that book is dense, like, yeah. But it's also a lot of talking heads, so it's dense because it's words. But
I feel bad. It's been sitting on my shelf for like 2 years.
Oh, I loved Ex Machina. Why The Last Man is my favorite like book.
I'm still reading I'm still somewhere in like volume 4 or 5 I finished.
I have read that book too many times. And it's one of those things where like some people like shit on it like happily. And I'm like, that's cool. And if some people don't dig it even in their top 10, I'm like, that's cool. But it is my one. Like, it's just... it's so superb. And issue 57, right towards the end, possibly the best issue I've ever read. Like, amazing. Just amazing levels of storytelling and craft. And it's just one of those books that just really grabbed me. Probably, you know, there's always a confluence of factors. It's right time, right place for me, for everything around it. I love that book. So take it as a stamp of approval, man. You should finish that book.
Yeah, that's what I do when I go to Wild Pig sales. I'm like, I have to remember which volume I left off.
Yes.
And then I always buy like 2 or 3 more volumes at Wild Pig. So I don't want to forget to mention this great book about Daredevil that you helped work on. I want to hear about this, and I'm sure everybody wants to hear about this. I mean, there's new talk about rebooting the movie franchise, but Daredevil is always sort of like he always seems to have been like a kind of a solid character where even if he was never like a top, you know, like an A-level character, but he was always steady.
Yeah, he's never been this blockbuster. The only time he's really risen to that height was when Kevin Smith relaunched him with Marvel Knights, and he was like, I think he was in the top 10 for most of those issues, like really went big, and then it sort of petered out. And he always sits in sales around, you know, the 40s, the 40 seller. But Daredevil is my favorite character, and so there's a publisher called SecArt, SecuArt, and they publish a lot of books sort of deconstructing comics as literacy works. And they recently did the Grant Morrison, is it Talking with Gods documentary, and a Warren Ellis documentary. They do a lot of really smart stuff. And I got into contact with them because of Tim Callahan, who writes the When Words Collide column at CBR. Him and I had been chatting a bit, and he went to a New York con a few years ago, and he's written a few SecArt books. He did Grant Morrison the early years, and he did the Legion of Superheroes book, and he was very kindly talking me up to the SecArt guys. So when they were putting together another book, which was all about Transmetropolitan, they put out the casting call for who would want to write essays for this book, and I was suddenly on that list. So I wrote an essay for that book, and then as much fun as that is, I was like, all right, now I want to do my own book with you guys, because, you know, I make insane leaps in what I should be allowed to do in this world. And for me, it was a no-brainer. I wanted to study Daredevil. He's an amazing character with just a superb history. And so I put together this pitch idea to the top guys, Julian and Mike at SecArt. And just sort of said, all right, here's like 15 different essays that you could write about Daredevil. And I had all these just insane ideas. And they got back to me and they were like, this sounds really interesting. We haven't done a lot of Marvel work, so that'd be cool to actually branch into that, because they usually seem to just, by as happenstance, do a lot of DC. And so they were like, all right, what we want you to do is we want you to take one of these essays and we want you to write it and submit that. So what we will then take to, you know, the unofficial board is your pitch, your overall idea, all of the essay ideas that you've listed, and then a sample essay so we can see that you're not illiterate. And I was like, yep, sweet. And so I went off and I wrote an essay. Now, they like their essays to be between, like, maybe 4,000 and 6,000 words. You can bump up to 8,000 words if you're feeling feisty. So I submitted an essay that was about, I think, 22,000 words.
Oh, that's way over.
Yeah. Yeah, but I ended up emailing them, and I was like, look, I want to write the essay that deconstructs Daredevil's love life. And he's got one hell of a love life. I was like, there's so much meat here. And so I went through it, and I was like, look, I can send you – it basically broke down into the five major loves of his life. I was like, I can either send you just the first part, which would be Karen Page, or I can just send it all to you, and you can just read the first part anyway. And they were like, send it all. So I sent it all through, and they loved it. So then we were off to the races. We started to pull in other writers and start getting them to pitch to me which essays that they would like to write. And so we've got some really, like, Julian Darius, who is the publisher there, is an insanely smart guy, and he wrote about the Dan Chichester run, and Tim Callahan came on and wrote about the Mike Murdoch years, which, for those who don't know, Matt Murdoch was nearly outed as Daredevil by Spider-Man. And so to avert the blame of being this vigilante, he invents a twin brother, Mike Murdoch, who is this obnoxious party boy. And for a fair chunk of Stan Lee's time on the title, Matt Murdock is moonlighting as Mike Murdock in scenes and coming in. And the best part is he ends up in a love triangle with Karen Page with his imaginary twin brother. It's insane. Like, it's
like a Brady Bunch episode.
Yes! It's so insane, but it's so much fun, and Stan Lee basically just gets to write Mike Murdoch as Stan Lee, really. The guy's a huckster, and he's an idiot, and it's awesome. And so Tim wrote this I love his essay on that. So there's that in there. Forrest Helvey is a really smart guy, got in there and wrote an essay. Kevin Thurman writes an essay. I got to write two, so I ended up writing about the love life, and we trimmed it down. I think we got it down to about 20,000 words. But if you think about each love, that works out to about, you know, five loves, or the five major loves. So we end up getting sort of 4,000 words each. And I also did a deconstruction of Ed Brubaker's run on the title, as it aligns with 70s, sort of film noir. And that was really fun too. I love Brubaker's run on Daredevil. It is my favorite. It isn't necessarily the best. I think you'd have to realistically give that to Frank Miller's first run on the title. But I love Brubaker's run. There's so much about it. And it really is – everyone sort of says Daredevil is this noir character because everybody just sort of says, oh, noir, you know, like crime. No, noir means a downward spiral. Noir means not a happy ending. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You can't say, oh, person's – fighting crime, he's noir. No, oh, he's in dark, shadowy panels. He's wearing a trench coat. It's noir. It's like, no. Noir is where the good guy doesn't win at the end. Or the good guy is the bad guy. You look at Brubaker's The Last of the Innocents. That is a sort of noir story in a very twisted way. Dark Knight, the criminal arc, I think that was his third. Dark Knight is brilliant. Oh, no, Bad Knight. is brilliant, and it is true noir. Like, it is not going places.
That's why you clicked so well with Wayne Szczesinski. He's like my king.
Yeah.
Noir, and got me hooked on some things.
He knows how to make things not end well. And so, yeah, I got to write all these fun essays, and it was in the book is in the May previews, page 379, I believe, and should be dropping in stores in August, I believe, that indicates. And it is available on Amazon at the moment, but we would obviously love some comic stores to do the pre-order so that we have a good numbers bump through Diamond would be very appreciated. So, I don't know, for me, being a process guy, I love reading about comics as much as I do reading comics. And so a book like this, if I knew it was coming out, being the Daredevil junkie that I am, I'd be buying multiple copies. This is the book I've waited for. But I was done waiting, so I just made it happen.
I think that's great. What's the title again? The Devil's in the Details?
The Devil is in the Details, Examining Matt Murdock and Daredevil.
All right. That's great.
Anyone who loves Daredevil will love it.
There's somebody on Twitter that I follow, Chris. I think technically her Twitter handle is like Chris_TOMP for the other Murdoch.
She's got an essay in the book.
Great, fantastic. The other Murdoch papers, I was going to say, there'd definitely be something she would want.
Oh, man, she wrote a really good essay on Foggy. And
great.
It's really, really good and really dense, and she's very scientifically minded, so I got the science essay, because there is one that looks at the science. It's actually written by a team of four European scientists, and it is full of so much math and symbols that I actually had to run it past Christine and be like, can you help me? Because I can tell it that the sentence, but it could be way off. And she read it, and she was like, no, this is really good. Can you tell them, have they thought about this? So I took her notes back to them, and they were like, interesting. And then they made some adjustments. It was really cool. So that essay, being a guy who, like, as soon as I could drop science at school, I totally did, because it just sort of bores me. I had to read this essay, like, a ton of times, and it was gripping. Like, it got me every time. So I was like, all right. A layman like me can get it, but it's definitely got enough high science in there that if you know your business, you could read it and go, all right, I see what they're talking about. So, yeah, we try to cover a bit of everything in the book.
And now, do you feel that this book is accessible to people who are not that familiar with Daredevil?
I think it would point you in the right directions of what to track down. Yes. I don't know. Like, people always talk about, is it a clean jumping on point? When I was like seven, I was thrown in a random issue of Claremont's X-Men, and it didn't throw me off. It made me go like, whoa, who's this Storm character? I want to know more. I want to track backwards. I'm a guy that doesn't mind doing that and can track backwards, and this book would be perfect for that. You could go through and just find all the issues that we reference and go, all right, I'm going to track those down. I had a guy in Seattle bought the book, and I was like, oh, man, that's awesome. Thanks for buying it. And he goes, yeah, I'm not really a massive Daredevil fan, but I've been hearing good things. I'm hoping this will help me get it. Can you point me towards, like, you know, what maybe the first things I should get? And him and I had this big 10-minute discussion. I was like, all right, I got to write this down. You need this, you need this, you need this. And I just sort of told him, go across the con floor, find the cheap trade sellers. I was like, you need the Frank Miller Masterworks. You need to get the Essentials one. You want to track down this Bendis trade, and sort of threw him to what he would need. And that was, oh man, that was an amazing moment for me. That was really cool. I was just like, all right, I hope you go off and love Daredevil. And I told him, I was like, dude, I want you to email me or tweet me or something and let me know how it all goes. So hopefully he's chewing through some back reading right now.
Oh, so you're bringing it to the masses there. I love that. I think it's great.
Oh, it was really a really cool moment. That was awesome. But yeah, I think anyone sort of could get into the book and then would just need to pad around it, which I think would be cool.
Cool. My other project that I didn't even realize until we had started our conversation is that you are one of the hosts from The Process, which
yes.
I love. I adore.
Ah, that's awesome.
You know,
yeah,
we have like these mutual friends. I'm like, wow, you know, Twitter brings us all together. It's great.
Oh, it's especially across oceans and continents. It's the greatest.
Yeah, so you talk about the process of making comics and with the, you know, the other co-hosts, Jeremy, and who else you got on?
We started off with Kurt Weed.
Right, started with Kurt. I was going to say, because he was like four, right?
Well, he eventually had to then sort of bail out. He's He's a superstar, you know.
Yeah, he is.
He's hard to get a hold of, and completely understandable. And so we brought Ed Brisson on board, and I think we've only...
Talented bastard.
Oh, man. Good man, too. But I think we've only recorded maybe one or two episodes with him. Maybe even, I don't know, not enough. And we need to sort of get back into that. But this year has been interesting for all of us involved because we're all getting other projects green lit, and time is not what it once was for really any of us. And so we're hoping to have more process soon. And I've been Ed and I have been doing a few sort of interview episodes where we've had other people on, but we haven't had a core process chat in before Emerald City, so it has been too long. And yeah, just through like all of us sort of having new projects coming up. I just had my second child, and she's very young and needy. And
Jeremy
trying to sort
a job
of,
and you know,
and Jeremy finally, yeah, got off the soup line, good kid, and you'll hate that I said that. Yeah, so we've just been, yeah, super. So, and you're trying to coordinate three different time zones, mine of which is the most awkward, so I always feel terrible that I'm letting us down. But for those who haven't heard it, it's on the Image Addiction podcast network, and the process deals with the process of writing, and we talk about how we're going with our writing and what we're reading that's inspiring us. And then we sort of take a listener question and we sort of give our 2 cents on it. And then we have like a little roundtable discussion around a topic, and it might be scripting, or it might be conventions, or it might be finding an artist, or it might be page turns, or it could be anything really. And we just sort of hatching it out. And, yeah, I've known like Kurt and Jeremy for a long time.
Yeah. And it's not, you don't have to worry about like, you don't have to worry about it being specifically heard at a time. Like, it's not outdated. You can go back and listen to them now.
Yeah.
And it's still, you know, you'll still get just as much out of it. It's not like things were, you know, so specific.
Well, we find a lot of people will find the podcast and then start listening to the back ones. And one person hit Jeremy and I up on Twitter and was like, I just listened to the latest process and started listening backwards through them all. And they're like, it's really weird. It's like you guys are becoming less successful the more I listen. Like, yeah, that sounds about right. Because when we started, I was like, oh, I'm trying to put some stuff together. And Jeremy and I had a chat about that recently. We were like, when we started the process, where were we? And what were we trying to do? And we're like, where are we now and what are we doing? And it's a face melter to just look at the good fortune and the hard work that has gone into sort of where we are now. And I know Jeremy's putting a lot of good stuff together for that will sort of land at the end of this year and into next year, and I'm working on the same. So it's really nice to see us sort of continue. Because I see some people out there that are like, oh, I'm going to break into comics, and they get a pitch together and it doesn't work, and they just sort of peter out. They just sort of disappear. But I like it. I've got a lot of writers that I follow on Twitter that are breaking in with us, and you just see them constantly plugging away, and there's a lot of hard work going on. And I mean, when we started up the process, my big thing was, would I listen to this podcast? And would I be inspired by it? Would I take something from it and go, all right, that's going to get me through today? And that's really, well, that's what I try to do with the show. I try to make sure we've got these things that will make you think, or will make you learn something new, or whatever the case may be. And I'm learning things on there constantly, or bringing new stuff that I've learned to the table. So it's a really fun project to do. And I hope that we can do more of it, but we certainly will do more of it as time moves forward. It's just too much fun not to, really.
Yeah. Well, you guys are getting all famous and stuff now, so it's understandable.
I think fame is a far stretch for my name, although the My Little Pony has cast my name.
Seriously.
Far. Yeah, that's been kind of cool.
You're going to be rolling in that pony money.
Oh, that pony cash. I know people are going to come up to my tables at the next two cons and be like, all right, where's your pony stuff? And I'll be like, I have this one shot here. What else are you going on? And I'll be like, I have this one shot called Fatherhood that is about a man trying to be a good father. And I'll be like, that's not a pony. You're a fraud, man. Like, yeah, it's going to be, it now widens the scope of what I have to offer for sale and for people to enjoy. And I don't know, that's why I did it. I like that. So hopefully people don't mind saying, I enjoyed you writing an all ages thing, and now I'm going to try you writing sci-fi pulp. Go for it.
Yeah, because I don't know what it is. I don't know why people think that that a writer can only do one specific thing. It's like, no, not at all. Have you seen, maybe back when I was growing up, like, we didn't pay attention to, like, who the writers on TV shows were.
Yeah.
You know, we just didn't. And now, like, everything is so connected. Like, hey, Straczynski wrote, like, all of these episodes of Murder, She Wrote, but he also did that sci-fi thing.
Yeah. It's good to stretch yourself. I think it's, otherwise, because I'm noticing a distinct theme in my writing, which is fatherhood. And it appears in the Survivor short I did with Daniel. It appears in my fatherhood one-shot from Challenge Comics. It's appearing in a project I have coming up soon. It's one of those things where I'm like, oh, okay, this theme keeps popping up again and again. And I'm like, all right, I don't mind having a similar theme. Let's not make it the same story, or let's not make it the same genre. And so I'm sort of branching it across sci-fi and crime and different sort of tropes like that. But, as much as being pigeonholed, I think it works, because then you can just go, all right, I'll write another horror story and it'll get picked up because I'm the horror writer. You also, you like to sort of spread out and try.
I do.
Try
you
to
know,
see
it's
what you can do.
It's just a mood thing, you know, and in a different part, different point in time in life, you know.
Yeah.
And even just from my own reading, like Tiny Titans was like my favorite comic, and you know, but I loved Tiny Titans as much as I loved the Lone Ranger and Zorro.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I'm like that with my TV viewing. Like, what the hell? I was just watching. I was having myself a Honey West marathon all day.
Nice.
So I was watching Honey West, but it's like, why? Because, well, like Netflix, I think the wind like knocked out my cable or something. So yeah. I was going to have like a My Little Pony marathon and it didn't happen. I'm like, all right, well, I've got these DVDs here. Let me put in some Honey West.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
whatever.
You can be multifaceted. You can enjoy those different things. And it's one thing to sort of receive different media, but then to express it is like, I had to really switch brains to write My Little Pony.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to get into that headspace. I was walking around on playground duty listening to, like, how the little kids would speak. And I'm like, all right, I've got to remember these ponies are like little girls and try and write it that way. And I would take these inflections back. And then I'd be writing Ghost Town. And I'm like, all right, now I'm writing. And it's such an American story, Ghost Town. And I'm not American. So I'm like, all right, I need to really, like, get into that and make sure I've got the voice down and understand their motivations. I mean, one big thing I realized recently was the global financial crisis. It actually hit America and affected people, which is weird for me because it, at least in my sphere of influence in Australia, I didn't see the GFC once. It didn't affect me or my job. It didn't affect my family. Didn't really affect anyone else in my family. All my friends have safe government jobs. Like, I just never really saw it. And I don't know if it hit Australia itself that hard. And we seemed to bounce back and through it. And we had a really good plan set up economically. And so I was just like, well, I hear about the GFC, but whatever. And then, like, you talk to some Americans and they're like, oh, no, this was devastating in certain places and to people I know. And I'm like, oh, okay. So when I write Ghost Town, I've got to think, like, this is a different economy. This is a different world. This is a different mindset.
Yeah, we got a lot of unemployment and stuff going on here.
Yeah. And so I can't just have my own sort of ideas and the way that I've lived feeding into some of this. You've got to really step outside of yourself. And
that's cool. You did a great job. You did an absolute great job on Ghost Town.
Thanks. I'm kind of nervous for it to drop. I got to admit, I'm like, oh, this is a, like when the Pony book dropped, I was so confident. It was awesome. And I can be a confident writer, but I, once it starts getting out there, I start to get the sweats. But with that Pony book, I was like, no, this is superb. And then it landed exactly how I thought it would. And I was like, oh man, woo, that was lucky. But with Ghost Town, I'm like, oh, I can see how some people won't like it. And there was, you know, the Boston bombings recently, and is it too soon, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's easy for me to write about this terrorism because we don't really have any down here, and it's not personal, but it will be for people that are buying this in the States. And so I'm trying to honor that, and I'm trying to fit it into this. It feels like a much tighter gap that I've got to slot through. And I really feel strong about – the entire opening arc. I feel – like I told a story that meant something and was personal and has some good beats and is pretty to look at and wraps up sort of thing. So I'm hoping it lands well, but yeah, between now and when it drops, it's sort of like, Well, we're about to go to war. Let's see what happens. So, you know, thank you. I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. And don't forget, guys, that you can go learn more about that at actionlabcomics.com. I always have to, like, look up their website because I'm like, was it Action Labs with an S? Is there an S? There's no S.
Yeah.
It's Action Lab Comics. Yeah. And, of course, follow them on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
At Ryan K. Lindsay.
Fantastic. And
if you have any Ghost Town questions, guys, or anything, or just want to chat, hit me up. I love Twitter.
Fantastic.
Love it.
And, of course, then go check out The Process at Image Addiction.
Yes.
And pester them to get that back up and running. Hey, yay!
Oh, yeah. Really do, because we're so... I think lazy is the term. I don't know. We're just
busy. No, you're just busy. You're busy. You know, you guys are having lives and stuff, and that's all right. That's all right. And don't, you know, please, you know, thank your darling wife for, you know, letting me bogart your time here.
Yeah, she just took the two kids to the mother-in-law. Well, her mother. So, yeah, she's lovely like that. I mean, our baby girl was, I think, 10 days old when I flew to Seattle for a week. My wife is amazing, and let it be known and heard. She is the best, the absolute best. And she doesn't ever listen to my podcast, so I'm not just doing this for her benefit. It's one of those things where I'm like, oh, man, I got lucky. Like, yeah, she's super, super supportive of me spending nights writing and going away to conventions for weekends or flying to the States. And that was a lot of money, too, but she pushed me into it. So,
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, she's the best. So it's important to have somebody behind you, guys and girls, that's for sure. Well, it is for me anyway.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, I'd get lazy otherwise.
All right. Of course, you can follow me at Elizabeth Amber on Twitter, and everything else that you are interested in, go to amberunmasked.com. So, Ryan, thanks so much for your time and joining me, and, you know, we'll hopefully get to, you know, continue our tweeting.
Absolutely. No, thank you for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure. This was more fun than I thought it would be, and I thought it was going to be heaps of fun, so... It's been a fantastic hour and a half. Thank you.
Thanks. And everybody, you have yourselves a lovely day, lovely evening whenever you're listening to this. And, of course, get over on Twitter, Elizabeth Amber. Cheers.